1 Samuel 25, the 19th talk in a series in 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on January 11, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at 1 Samuel chapter 25. As we left off last week, we have Saul and David playing cat and mouse in the Judean wilderness. There are periods of time when Saul relents and decides that he shouldn't be pursuing David, and apparently goes back to his palace. But then once back at his palace, he begins to reflect again, and his suspicions grow, and he can't help himself but head out to the wilderness again to try to find David and kill him. Last week, Deb asked which psalms deal with this period of time. There are eight that are specifically stated that they deal with this period of time in David's life. I'll read them to you, but I can give them to anybody afterwards if you don't get all the numbers. And this is in approximate chronological order. Psalm 7, 59, 56, 34, 52, 57, 142, and 54. And then there are two others that talk more generally about David's trials, and they seem to, they apparently are primarily in reference to this time, and that's Psalms 18 and 63. So there are a number of psalms that David wrote describing his feelings during this period when Saul was trying to chase him and kill him, and it had a significant impact on his life, clearly. Well, this cat and mouse game that Saul and David are playing continues during the period of the next two or three chapters. And that's the context in which this is set. We'll look at 1 Samuel 25. We'll just start out with just the first two verses, first one verse. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now Samuel, as you will recall, was the man who came along, raised up by God to provide spiritual leadership for Israel. And he is the one who provided that leadership and anointed Saul to be king. And then when Saul turned away from God, was not obedient to God, Samuel, at the direction of God, anointed David as his replacement. Well, now he has died, so his period of time comes to an end. It says that all Israel gathered together to mourn for him. Samuel had provided good leadership for a significant period of time when Israel needed good leadership. And Israel apparently responded to him. And he was buried in his house. Interestingly, this is not an Israelite custom, generally speaking, for someone to be buried in their house. It has been archaeologically determined that this was a Ugaritic custom. Ugarit is just to the north of Israel in what is now Lebanon. So this is unusual, but that's what happened. He was buried in his house at Ramah. Ramah was the city from which he originally came. And then it says that David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Apparently there's a connection here. Apparently Samuel is providing a certain amount of restraint with respect to what Saul can do when he comes after David. That Samuel is having some kind of restraining influence. But now Samuel's dead, and David takes off way to the south. If you look on your maps, the wilderness of Paran is south of the Dead Sea, on the west side of the Arabah, but it's south of Judah. So he has left Judah once again. And we don't know how long he goes down there, but apparently he then returns from the wilderness Paran back to Judea, because that's where the action in the next part takes place. Verses 2 through 8. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about when he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, 'Have a long life, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have.' And now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David." So there's a wealthy man. This is in Hebron, near Hebron. It's in the part of Israel that's the tribe of Judah. He's a very wealthy man, living in Maon, but apparently many of his flocks are in Carmel. It lists his wealth as 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. That's significant. He's quite well off. And it has come the time of year that they collect, it's kind of their harvest. They shear the sheep and they have festivities to celebrate the end of the agricultural year for them. And the narrator takes some time out here to characterize this man and his wife. The man's name is Nabal, which literally means fool. That's a cruel thing for parents to name their child. And apparently he lives up to his name. It says with respect to the man that he was harsh and evil in his dealings, and we'll see as it goes on. He is not a good guy. It also says that he was a Calebite, which is a curious thing to throw in here. Caleb, as you'll recall way back in Numbers, Caleb was one of the spies that was sent into Israel when the Israelites were about to enter into the land. And he was one of the two that came back with good reports and encouraged the Israelites to go in, while all of the other spies had negative reports and discouraged the Israelites from going in. Caleb was apparently not of Jewish blood. He was a Kenite, and they had been absorbed into the tribe of Israel in their wanderings. And they had been absorbed into Israel, assimilated, and had become a part of the tribe of Judah. So this man is a part of the tribe of Judah. Now, why it mentions it here is not clear, but it is curious that the word Caleb means dog. And a dog in Jewish culture, in Israelite culture, had the reputation of being a scoundrel, having no good sense. So it could be that this has been thrown in just to further characterize this man and what he's like. His wife is quite a contrast to him. Abigail means, "My father is delighted." Abigail, as opposed to Nabal, she is intelligent or of good sense. And beautiful. So she is a star. She's characterized here as being in stark contrast to her husband. And that becomes significant as we go on. Now, David has heard that the shearing time has come for Nabal and his household. And it would have been customary for all of the people of significance in the surrounding area to send a greeting to the household when it's engaged in the shearing time. It's a big event in our culture. Well, it's not my culture, but in cowboy culture, as I understand it, branding time is a similar kind of event, festive event, and everybody around helps out. And that seems to be a similar kind of phenomenon to the shearing time in Israel. Well, David sends his greetings and extends his wish of peace on Nabal and his family. But he has a request that's kind of buried in his greeting. He points out that Nabal's shepherds have been shepherding their flocks in the area around Carmel. And David's men have been in that area. And David's men have been very kind towards Nabal's shepherds. They haven't insulted them. They haven't taken anything from them. And furthermore, they've been watching over the area, keeping the peace. And so there's a sense in which Nabal's prosperity owes something to David and his men's efforts to maintain the peace and order in that area. So David asks that Nabal show favor towards David and his men and provide them with whatever they have at hand. Any food, any extra sheep, any extra grain that they send at David's way. I suspect that David is looking at this much in the way that one would think about taxes. We pay taxes in order for the government to keep society running smoothly so that we can live our lives in peace. The government has never asked us for taxes. Would you please send me the money? But it is a requirement that we send the money. And it isn't a contractual agreement that we've entered into. We just have an obligation to pay that money for the services that are rendered by the government. David is actually asking here, but I think he's thinking about this much along the lines of taxes. David has provided a service. David has been the local government in that part of Judah, and he is thinking it would be right for the people who have benefited from that, from the peace that I have maintained, to provide me with and my men with food. So that's the request. Next section. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited. But Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?" So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. And David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. So the response of Nabal, well, David's men, they make this request and then they wait for Nabal's response. Presumably this is customary that they may not have delivered this request to Nabal directly, but then they're waiting for the response to come back to them. Nabal's response is offensive. Nabal says, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? In other words, David, you're a nobody. Why should I pay anything to you? He goes on further and says, why should I give it to men whose origin I do not know? That is interesting, and in contrast to what David had said in his request, let's see, where is it? I'm not finding it, but someplace David refers to Nabal as his brethren. I don't see it right now. But in any case, one of the things that apparently Nabal is questioning is, David is thinking, we are fellow tribesmen. That it only makes sense that my fellow tribesmen would help, would give me food in exchange for the services that I have provided. Nabal's saying, I don't even know where you come from. Denying that there is that kind of tie of kinsmanship. And he says, there are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master, suggesting that David is a rebel, which is interesting because that's the thing that David has denied all the way along. David has been claiming, I am not a rebel. I am loyal to Saul. The only reason I'm running is because Saul wants to kill me. I've done nothing to justify his suspicions. So David is not a rebel. So everything that Nabal is saying here is offensive to David. He's not only refusing to send food, he's offending David. So David's men go back to David. And by the way, when David sent the men, there were 10 young men. So it was quite a contingent that he had sent. They were all warriors. I'm not sure whether it was a display of his power that he would send that many, or whether it was an indication of respect. I'm not sure exactly why he would have sent so many warriors with that message, but it must have been significant. But they retrace their steps, they go back, and they tell David exactly what Nabal had said to them. David has little patience. This has punched his buttons, and David says, get your swords on, we're headed out. And they are going to exact revenge on Nabal. Next section. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. So apparently this is a servant. This is someone who apparently works for the household of Nabal. And he knows what's going on. He knows the nature of the response that Nabal made to David. And he knows, I don't know whether he knows that David has commanded them to get their swords on, or whether he's just speculating that is the likely response. But he has a good sense of what's going on, and he knows they're in trouble. So he approaches Abigail. Apparently there's no one else that can talk some sense to Nabal. And he has good reason to think that Abigail might respond differently. So he addresses her, and he explains to her the situation. Apparently she was not aware of what was going on. And he understands that Nabal's response to David was one that would be offensive. And he testifies to the fact that David's men treated them very well, that they were a defense for the servants, for the shepherds and the herds, and that they did protect them, did all of the things that David's men had said that they had done for Nabal. So this young man says to Abigail, basically, you've got to do something. Time's running out. This is an urgent matter. You have to do something. No one else can talk sense to Nabal. The next section. Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I am coming after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And it came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain, that behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and much more, and more also, if by morning I leave as much as 1 male of any who belong to him." So Abigail puts together a large amount of food. I don't know that it's not an enormous amount of food considering David has 600 men, but it's a large amount of food. She puts that all together on the backs of donkeys, and she sends those out in front of her. This is something, if you remember back into Genesis, Esau did the same thing when he was coming to meet Jacob, and he feared that Jacob was going to want to kill him. So he sent gifts in advance of his coming. Abigail's doing the same thing here. The gifts are going before she arrives so that David can see that she's coming with good intentions. She does all of this without Nabal's knowledge. She hasn't consulted with him at all. She's taking this action on her own initiative. They meet her. David's men eventually meet her. The gifts have preceded her. And David gives his complaint. "My men have guarded Nabal's men for all of this time, and look how he responds to us. It's outrageous." And he says, "If by morning I leave as much as 1 male of any who belong to him, then may God do so, do to me as I would do to my enemies." So David's intention is to wipe out the household, kill all of the male members of the household to get revenge for Nabal's response. Next section. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. And she fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my lord, be the blame. Please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my lord be as Nabal. And now let this gift, which your maidservant has brought to my lord, be given to the young men who accompanied my lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my lord an enduring house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you all your days. And should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And it shall come about when the Lord shall do for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and shall appoint you ruler over Israel, that this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause, and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord shall deal well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. So Abigail's response is, as soon as she sees David, she gets off her donkey, and she comes and she bows down before David in a sign of respect, the kind of respect that her husband had not had for David. And she says, on me alone, my Lord, be the blame. So she wants to take all of the blame for her household on herself rather than having it fall on Nabal. And she says, don't pay attention to him. He's foolish. He doesn't have his head on straight. Don't take his response seriously. Don't take his response for the response of his household, because it's not representative. And then she suggests that God has set this up. This is God's doing. God has allowed Abigail to intervene in this situation and to have a word with David such that David will not carry out the revenge that he has intended, because that would have been a bad thing. And God has saved him from doing that bad thing that he... And she says, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. That anyone, because David will not seek vengeance here, then anyone who seeks evil against him should be counted as a fool. So she says, accept the gift and please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. So she is indeed taking on the blame of what has happened on herself. And she's saying, forgive me for what her husband had done. And on what basis should she forgive? Should David forgive her? She says, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord, that is David, an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you all your days. So it's three things: that God is making for David an enduring house. Secondly, David is fighting the battles for the Lord. David is a true representative of God. And the third, and evil shall not be found in you all your days. That there's a purity there in David and his house. And it's on that basis then that David should forgive her and the household. Then she uses this analogy, the analogy of, apparently it's two bags of stones. One bag of stones is the living, and the other bag of stones is those that are to be thrown with a sling, thrown away. And she says, and should anyone rise up to pursue you and seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. So it's in the bag of stones that will live, continue to live. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. So those are the stones that are going to be thrown away. So she's saying, those who align with themselves with you are aligning with the living, the ones who will be preserved. Those who are enemies of you are like those who will be thrown away. Their lives will be extinguished. And then she says, may God do what he's promised to do, that you will be the anointed, he will appoint you ruler over Israel, and that you will not be troubled in your conscience for having done wrong here by avenging yourself in this situation. And then she concludes by saying, and when this comes to pass, when you are appointed king over Israel, remember your maidservant. It's very interesting. She is fully aligning herself with David, identifying with his mission and the fact that David is associated with Yahweh, closely associated with Yahweh, a representative of Yahweh, and recognizing that fact. And counting on that fact. Next section. Then David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment. And blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you and granted your request. So David responds positively. He relents in his anger. He decides that he will not carry out the vengeance that he had set out to gain. He's not going to kill anyone, but had she not come, he would have done it. Next section. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But it came about in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, that his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, it happened that the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from the evil. The Lord has also returned the evil doing of Nabal on his own head. Then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, David has sent us to you to take you as his wife. And she arose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, behold, your maidservant is a maid to wash the feet of my Lord's servants. Then Abigail quickly arose and rode on a donkey with her 5 maidens who attended her, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. So Abigail, after having talked with David, returns back to the household, and when she gets back, they are celebrating. They're celebrating this event of shearing the sheep, and Nabal has become very drunk. And so Abigail elects not to tell him anything at this particular point in time. She waits until morning when he has sobered up before she says anything. At that time, she tells him what she has done. And at that time then, it says that Nabal's heart died within him so that he became as a stone. I don't know what happened here. One of the commentaries suggested that this may have been a stroke, and the stroke may have been triggered by Abigail telling him what she had done, that may have shocked him, that she would have been so insubordinate. But in any case, something physically has happened that can be described as he became as a stone. Whether he's in a coma or what is not clear. But then 10 days later, he actually dies. And when he dies, the narrator points out that it happened that the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. So David heard that Nabal had died, and he sends word to Abigail. And because of the way that Abigail had comported herself in talking to David, David was obviously very impressed. And Abigail had concluded by saying, remember me. When these things that have been promised you have come to pass, remember me. In other words, asking for David to keep her in mind as time goes on. Well, David remembers her sooner rather than later, and he sends word to her that he would like to marry her, and she consents and goes back with David's men to meet with David along with her servants. Then the last couple of verses, David had also taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both became his wives. Now Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. So these last two verses are just clarifying David's current marital status. He has two wives then. He's now married to Abigail. He had already been married to Ahinoam of Jezreel, and that was not mentioned previously. That's new information to us as we're reading through 1 Samuel. So he has those two wives at this point. It did mention earlier in the text that he was married to Saul's daughter, Michal. But apparently, after David fled, Saul gave Michal away to another man, to Palti. So she is living as the wife of this other man at this particular point in time, even though technically she is still married to David. And we'll see that becomes a complicated issue in 2 Samuel. Okay, some observations on this section. The first is with respect to Samuel and the announcement of his death. Samuel was the last of the judges. That during the period of the judges, God would raise someone up, and Israel with charisma, and the people of Israel would respond to that charisma and that person's leadership, and that leader would lead Israel against a specific enemy that was harassing them at that particular time. That was the only form of government, really, that existed in Israel during the period of time after they entered into the promised land until now. And it was that form of government that the Israelites didn't like. And the thing they didn't like about it is it wasn't consistent. You couldn't count on it. You didn't know for sure when God was going to raise up the next leader. And there were periods of time, apparently, when they lacked that leadership. And they wanted the kind of consistent leadership that they could count on, like the surrounding nations had, and that's why they requested a king. And it was Samuel who said, "You don't want that. That would be a bad thing." But they insisted, and God relented and asked Samuel to anoint for the people of Israel a king. So it's Samuel who introduces the kingship to Israel, and he's this transitional figure between the period of the judges and the kingship. As I think about Samuel and his life, there must have been frustration there, because Samuel dies before this transition happens. Samuel dies when things are still chaotic. And there must be a sense in which Samuel would be looking at all that's happened, and it looks like his work isn't done. But I suspect that's true for all of us, that all of us are going to die with things left undone. And it's important, I think, for us to keep in mind that we all play just this bit part in a much bigger history. And God is accomplishing his purposes over a long period of time. And things really are not done until the end. That for however many millennia human beings have been on this earth, things have never been completed. Things have never been tied up into a nice package. Things finished. That is yet to come. So we all play our bit part on something that we will not see through to its end. It won't happen. We just play our bit part. We aren't the hero. Someone else plays the role of the hero. The Christ plays the role of the hero. We just play a bit part. And we won't see that kind of completion in our lifetime. A second thing of interest. Abigail, when she approaches David, decides to take upon herself blame for the entire household, which is a great strategy, because by taking the blame on herself, she puts a different face on the household that David has decided to punish. And she puts a different face, and that face is of such a nature that it's harder for him to maintain his wrath. She's a very different person from her husband. And she knows that David is less likely to carry out his vengeance if he gets the food that he had wanted, he gets the respect that he should have received, and if he sees someone addressing him with good sense and graciousness, as Abigail does. And it works. David relents in his wrath against Nabal's household. And it strikes me that there is in this kind of a picture of the Christ to come. That the Christ to come plays a similar kind of role and takes the blame upon himself and intervenes and assuages the wrath of God and his vengeance that would otherwise be justified. Third thing of interest. There's a theme that's kind of running through this section of 1 Samuel, and that is that God is the avenger. It is not our place to extract vengeance. David recognizes that with respect to Saul, and he's mentioned that. I mean, Saul has done horrible things to David. David would be justified, in a sense, in killing Saul. And he had the opportunity when he could have, but he didn't get vengeance. His perspective was, that's God's job, it's not my job. So with respect to Saul, David has things in good perspective, and he's able to maintain that perspective. In this situation, David lost sight of that. He lost perspective. And it took Abigail and her actions to bring him to his senses and to realize more fully that vengeance is the Lord's, it's not ours. Just, it seems to me that it is very common in my life that I will learn a lesson, and I think truly learn a lesson, a truth, but later on in my life, events will present themselves in such a way that I forget that truth with respect to these circumstances. And it's the constant task of relearning things I already learned, but learning them better. And that's what's happened to David here. A fourth thing of interest. We talked about this a little bit in the questions last week, but another theme that's running through here is those who recognize and grant respect to God's anointed are recognizing and granting respect to God himself. That Abigail, in her response to David, is recognizing the special role that David plays in history. He's not just anybody. He's the anointed. He's going to be the king. And she understands that, recognizes that, and acknowledges it, embraces that, and even counts on that. And so David becomes kind of a litmus test for determining how people are responding to God himself. That as people respond to David, that's how they respond to God. I think that there is a parallel kind of phenomenon that I'm going to throw out here, and I'm sure we can debate this. But if I understand what God is doing in history correctly, what he has done, what he's going to do, and especially with respect to the nation Israel, that God selected out a special people, one people out of all of the earth. And he did so because he wanted them to be uniquely representative of him, of God, and God's values. They were to be a royal priesthood to the rest of the world. They served that function of being our moral beacon. They're supposed to help us keep track of what is right and what is wrong, what's valuable and what's worthless. So God selected this people out of all the people of the world to provide that kind of example and guidance to the rest of the world. They've never fully played that role. They've never fully done what they were asked to do, that they were chosen to do. But I think, if I understand where things are going correctly, and I understand the biblical passages with respect to this, that is yet to happen, that the time will come when God's people, the people of Israel, will yet play that role. But they have not yet, and they are not doing that today. But I think that, similar to David, how we respond to the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, even today, is to one degree or another indicative of how we respond to God himself. That we ought to respond to the descendants of Abraham as Abigail responded to David. And that is to say, be respectful, to be willing to even criticize and say, you didn't do that right, when they don't do something right. But all along, be rooting for them, cheering them on to play the role that they were destined to play. That there's a sense in which we should be hoping and praying that the descendants of Abraham would indeed become the moral beacon to the rest of the world that they were originally chosen to be. And I think if that's true, that's interesting, especially in light of current events. The fifth thing I want to talk about that I think is significant in this passage. This is an interesting story with respect to the issue of what it means to be submissive to authority. Presumably, Abigail had the obligation to be submissive to Nabal as her husband, that she was to be subservient to him, recognize his authority as her husband. And yet, she acts against his will. And I think that we are supposed to see what she has done as being exemplary. So she has been submissive, and yet she has been disobedient. Can the two run together? Can the two be consonant? this question of what it means to be submissive is another one of the themes that's running through 1 Samuel. In particular, it has been an issue that's been raised with respect to our submissiveness to God. If you remember way back, to soon after Saul had been anointed and had taken his place as king of Israel, if you'll recall, God sent the Israelites out to attack the Amalekites, and they did so under Saul's leadership, and they were successful. But God had told them to kill everyone and kill all of the livestock. And they did not do so. Saul listened to the people and their request to save out animals, spare animals for themselves. And Saul listened to them. And for that, he was condemned by Samuel. And that's why he was rejected as king. And so this is a theme that's come up before. Let me read what Samuel said to Saul at that time. This is from 1 Samuel 15. It's 22 and 23. And he said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." So his complaint is that, well, what Saul said when he said that he had kept the animals back was that they were going to use them for sacrifices. Samuel's response is, "God would rather have your obedience than your sacrifices. God wants your heart. He wants your devotion to him more than he wants outward compliance to the religious ritual." So this, I think, is a theme that's running through 1 Samuel, the question of what does it mean to be submissive to authority. But to be submissive to God's authority, I think, is different from being submissive to human authority. Because God is inerrant. God is infallible. If God tells us to do X, we ought to do X. So with respect to God, submission is identical to obedience. When it's with respect to human authority, I don't think that equation quite holds. What we're asked to, in being submissive, is to have a heart of service with respect to. And it is possible with human beings that they don't understand what's in their own interests. They do make mistakes. They are inconsistent, etc. Such that there can come the time when to be submissive would be to be disobedient. And I think that's what we're seeing in Abigail here. True submission to human authority is not equal to, identical to obedience, but rather it comes down to having a heart of service and devotion to that authority. And that would be consonant to the kind of submission that we ought to have with God. I hadn't really thought about that with respect to that issue until I was studying this passage, but it raises a problem that I face frequently when I study the Bible, that what is required of us in our day-to-day lives is an enormous amount of judgment. That things aren't all spelled out for us, that in these circumstances you do X, in these circumstances you do Y. But rather we are to understand God's set of values and artfully figure out what those set of values result in, what kind of action those result in a specific set of circumstances. And that's, on the one hand, that's very freeing. On the other hand, it just requires so much judgment and wisdom that I often lack. But that is the way God has so set things up. And the result of it is we are constantly having to go back and look at our understanding of what God values and see whether our values are in line with those. It requires a lot more reflection on our part than would rote obedience. God requires of us an active mind, I think. Okay. Questions, comments?
Regarding what you had said about rooting for Israel, would that mean when they're involved in a war of any kind like they are now, that we root for them?
Well, no, it doesn't. I don't think it means that exactly. As with Abigail decided that David was bent on doing an action that was wrong. And so she confronted him and talked to him and convinced him to do otherwise. Similarly, I don't think we should just assume that everything that Israel does is right, or treat everything that Israel does is right. We need to have judgment and decide what's going on here and why, and is that indeed a praiseworthy action or not. So I don't think it translates into that. What we are to be rooting for is not that they always win, but they become but that as a nation they become the kind of people that God wanted them to be. In that sense, root for them. Root for them to play the role that God assigned to them from the beginning, from the time of Abraham.
Thank you for that. I was considering the kingdom where Israel was to be a royal priesthood, mm-hmm. that they had the priesthood as a result of apostasy, actually, from God, through the idolatry of the old golden calf. Then they got a priesthood. Mm-hmm. It's actually, they weren't supposed to have one. And the same with the kingdom. Their idea of stable leadership, I mean, they had Samuel for decades, and there's nothing to have prevented God from raising up another prophet for right. decades.
Right.
But what they wanted was a king to lead them out in battles like all the other nations. That is, to go and conquer other people, take their land, enslave their people, and grab their wealth mm-hmm. like all the other nations.
Right.
And his response was not that the king would provide stability, but that he would tax them and draft their young men and make virtual slaves of them for the maintenance of the state. I look at the kingdom and the adoption of the state as a sign of apostasy. Is that reasonable?
Yes, I think that's right. But what's interesting is that rather than God condemning the existence of kingdoms, period, God does what he has done in other times in history, in other aspects of human existence. He takes what man has done in his rebelliousness and he transforms it for his own purposes. So in the end of time, will we have another period of judges? No, we have a kingdom. So God is going to take that kingdom, which was born out of rebelliousness, and transform it for his own purposes as an instrument of righteousness. He's done that with other things. I mean, he's taken our sinfulness, period. Something that was done as an act of rebelliousness against him. And he's actually going to use that for good and righteous purposes. That is, he's going to transform us into people who really appreciate him as a gracious and loving God in a way that we otherwise would not. So yes, it was born of rebelliousness, but God is capable of transforming it, and he will for his purposes.
David, thank you for this. Would you comment earlier in chapter 15 in 1 Samuel when God gives the commandment to... is a pretty controversial passage, actually, I think, to kill every man, woman, and child along with the sheep and the goats. In the context of the Deuteronomy 7 thing where God kind of talks about, I've chosen you to be a holy people, not because of your righteousness, just because I felt like it, you know. But in chapter 15, he commands, you know, them to kill everybody, but they spare the animals, as you pointed out later. But could you talk a little bit about the men, women, and the children in that?
You mean why? How could it be justified to have
Yeah, because you alluded to the fact that we need to look at Israel and kind of say, is this a good thing they did or a bad thing that they did? And obviously, they're being commanded directly by God to do this.
Right.
That would be something probably we wouldn't consider a good thing.
Right. Right. That is a difficult issue. We have to assume that God knew what he was doing when he asked the Israelites to do that. And I think there are enough indications in the Old Testament passages that God was going to visit judgment on the land of Canaan. And the Israelites were going to be the instrument of that judgment that was going to be visited on the land of Canaan. And that judgment was justified. And I can only assume that the same holds true of what Saul was supposed to do with the Amalekites. That was a judgment that God wanted to visit on that particular group of people, and he had good reasons for doing so. Instead of using fire and brimstone like he used them in Sodom and Gomorrah, he used the instrument of the Israelites to carry that out in the Amalekites. It is interesting that had we lived at the time and been looking in at the time, reading the headlines and all that sort of thing, it would have looked unjust. I mean, what would justify that kind of thing? And I don't. I mean, it's hard to assess that kind of thing. I don't know how we would have known that was a just judgment brought about by the hand of God in that particular set of circumstances. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Right. And God visits death on human beings on a daily basis. Sometimes that is judgment. Sometimes it's just for his purposes are such that it's that person's time is up.
David, when Abigail meets with David and goes through the three things that she wishes for him, the middle one was for his purity.
Yes. And
how do you, it's sort of interesting that later on she, I don't know how polygamy works when he commits adultery in terms of how the society would view that or how she would feel when that happened to her. But how do you respond to that? Because obviously he had his problems.
You're talking about with Bathsheba?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. When we get to that, we'll talk more about it. But the story of David and Bathsheba is phenomenal in a lot of respects. I think it's a really one of the most significant passages in the Bible. David committed horrendous evil. There's no question about it. But even that horrendous evil was forgivable by God. And God did forgive it because of the contrition of David's heart. And in the end, I think what we're supposed to see with David is, in the end, he has a heart that is devoted to God. There are times when he does horrible things over the course of his life, but he has a pure heart. We are told that he has, heart after his own father. David truly is committed to goodness in the final analysis, despite the fact that it is horrendous evil. So I think what she says is true, is ultimately true of David, that there is a purity there. Anything else?
Margaret has an announcement just a minute. I'm sorry, I forgot to put this in four pages, and so I'm announcing it now. This is totally rabbit trail here. Does anybody else have a question for David? That's okay, guess not. I forgot to put an announcement for Debbie Blanchard in four pages. She wanted me to announce that ORI, Oregon Research Institute, is looking for people to participate in a study of how exercise affects Parkinson's disease. I hope none of you has Parkinson's, but if you do, or if you know anybody who does, they're looking for people to participate in this study. So if you would contact Debbie Blanchard, she would appreciate it. Thanks.
Anything else? Okay, thanks.